Well, the last time we chatted, it was a couple of years ago, and that was on the occasion of the Angel of Zen. And that was with poor Saul Stein's house. Saul has had some problems since then. But you swapped publishing houses now. You're with Summit, so they seem pretty solvent. Saul didn't go down leaving you any money, did he?
No.
I understand that his books have been tied up.
I don't know anything about this. I didn't know that. Yeah. See, I'm living in Mexico, so I don't follow the ins and outs of New York publishing.
Economic gossip. You know?
But I've been published by Summit before, so this is really a reunion.
Well, The Angel of Zen came. It was 2 years ago or three?
Two or three years.
But obviously you haven't been sitting on your laurels, so to speak, over those couple of years. You've been obviously working, so tell me a little bit about what you've been doing before we actually go into Daddy's Girl.
Well, I've been primarily working on Daddy's Girl, which was a long and involved project and required spending nearly a year in Houston and attending one murder trial after another. And then, since then, I've started a new novel, and I've written a screenplay, which is now on ice because of the writer's strike.
And well, I would think that living in rural Mexico would make you complacent and lazy, but that's not the case, is it?
No, I'm not lazy. I'm the same everywhere. I just live there because I love it, and it's clean and cheap and beautiful and a little backward.
What town is it?
A town called San Miguel Allende in central Mexico. It's on the high plateau, about 160 miles north of Mexico City. And I like it because I get up in the morning and there are riders going out to tend the cows and the bulls and guys playing guitars on the streets. And it sort of takes me back to a world I think I'd rather live in.
What kind of house do you live in?
It's a moderately old house with a big garden in back, which I tend. Mm-hmm. And on a narrow cobbled street, quite old fashioned.
Is this one of the historical districts? This town?
Yeah, the town is a monument, so styled by the Mexican government, and it can't be changed without permission of the government. So it retains its character, despite the fact that there are a couple of thousand gringos who live there, most of whom are elderly and retired, so you don't see them until there's a concert, and then there's a sea of white heads.
Mexico, then, is hospitable to gringos and people who have taken up residency there on a permanent basis like yourself.
Yes, it is, because we bring in money and we provide jobs for people who otherwise would be sleeping on the streets. So that unless you're a loud, pushy American who doesn't like Mexicans, you're welcome there. You just have to be careful not to make a pass at a Mexican's woman or insult him, because then he'll shoot you.
Well, you would never do that.
I sure
would.
You've
never been known to make a pass at a woman.
Not a Mexican.
Do you get into Mexico City very much?
Now and then. It's a dirty city, full of smog.
It's been years since I've been in Mexico City. It was quite nice when I was there. I guess it's been maybe 10 years, but I've read about all of the population problems and traffic congestion. It sounds like a nightmare.
It's awful. I'm told there are 1,000 new people who come to Mexico City every day from the outlying provinces, so that the outside of the city, which they call the Belt of Misery, gets really choked up. Not nice. There is a small section where the tourists go called the Pink Zone, which is very pleasant. The good hotels, the good restaurants are there. So you can have the illusion that everything is okay in Mexico, unless you look hard. I really don't spend much time in Mexico City except on my way back and forth from the airport.
Well, don't you have, to do some major shopping once in a while? You can't get it way down the steps.
I can do that. Major shopping I would do in the city of Querétaro, which is about 45 minutes from where I live, or I would drive up to Texas, which I do anyway, about twice a year, to go to the dentist.
You were in Mexico when you heard about this sensational murder case in Houston. What did you find out about this?
I knew very little at the beginning, other than that a beautiful young private eye named Kim Paris had seduced the alleged murderer into a confession. And that titillated me.
Did you read that in the papers?
No, somebody told me about it on the telephone. I don't read the papers down there. Oh, occasionally, but I didn't see that in the papers. By coincidence, I was going up to Houston to see the dentist. And when I got there, I looked up Kim Paris and Clyde Wilson, her boss, the head of the detective agency that employed her, and got very much interested in the case. So much interested that I moved quickly to write a book about it. I mean, I knew right away there was a story there. It turned out to be a completely different story from the one that I'd originally envisioned.
But you began to be involved in this case even before the case went to trial.
That's right. I met most of the protagonists. I met the murderer, the accused murderer. I met the detectives. I met all the cops, the district attorney, the defense lawyers, and became friendly with all of them, including the judge, so that I was part of the gang, so to speak. Texas is a strange place. If they like you, they really like you, and they welcome you, and they open up to you, as long as you're straight with them. And I had privileges that one rarely gets as an investigative journalist.
Let's get to that in just a moment, but perhaps you can just sort of outline broadly the details of this sensational murder. Who was murdered? What happened?
In 1982, a couple named James and Virginia Campbell, he a lawyer, she a paralegal who worked with him in his office, were brutally murdered in their beds in the middle of the night. No clues, no fingerprints, no witnesses, except two small boys sleeping at the foot of the bed, their grandchildren. But they didn't see anything, they said. The murder went unsolved for 2.5 years. The chief suspect was one of the four Campbell daughters, whose name was Cindy Ray. But there was no proof, although the police suspected her and her boyfriend, a young fellow named David West, an ex-Marine. 2.5 years later, the other surviving daughters of the murdered couple hired a private detective to try and break the case, because they were dissatisfied with the way the police investigation had gone. And the private detective, lo and behold, broke the case. She went to see David West under an assumed name, convinced him that she was in love with him, wanted to marry him, bear his children, and said to him that she was psychic, and she needed from him the deepest secrets of his soul. And she said, "David, you're hiding something from me, and I won't sleep with you, and I won't marry you until you tell me what it is." And the poor sucker told her. And what it was that he had murdered the parents of his former girlfriend in order to avenge the sexual abuse that her father had heaped upon her from the age of 13 onward.
Alleged sexual abuse.
Yes.
It was never established.
No, it was never proved. The only way it could have been, in a sense, proved was if Cindy Ray, the daughter, had taken the witness stand in the trial, but she didn't. However, it was discussed thoroughly at trial. The prosecutor tried to mock it and keep it out of evidence and convince the jury that it had never taken place and that, in fact, the murder was for greed, for one quarter of the Campbell estate. I believe it did happen.
Now, you were there and talking to all the principals with the understanding that you would probably make a book out of this. Isn't that true?
Oh, they knew I was writing a book. That's how I gained entree. But the advantage I had over a newspaper journalist was that they could talk to me and be sure, or fairly sure, that I wasn't going to print it in tomorrow's papers or broadcast it on the radio that day. And so they could tell me things in confidence if they trusted me, which they learned to do. They knew it wouldn't come out in print for a year or two.
Well, there's a precedent in that kind of reportage. Truman Capote did it with In Cold Blood. So this is not necessarily an unusual thing for you to be so involved with the people in this case.
My involvement became unusual in the sense that I wound up as a witness at the trial. Because having been there for so long, doing so much research out on the street, so to speak, I found out things that neither the prosecutor nor the defense knew. And in the trial of David West, the first trial, I came up with a witness, hitherto unknown, who, if he had taken the stand, would have driven the nail into David's coffin. At that point, David decided to confess to having killed the Campbells, turned state's witness against his former girlfriend, Cindy Ray. When she went to trial, I was called as a witness on the stand because I knew that several of the other witnesses were lying. And the defense asked me to testify to that.
You weren't afraid that this might jeopardize you, compromise you as an investigative reporter in this case?
I was very much afraid of it. And I remember calling my lawyer and friends of mine in New York and seeking advice as to what to do. And they said, hey, you got to tell the truth. You know, if it's important, do it. And so I did.
So you took the witness stand. Was there any effort by the lawyers to portray you as a felon?
Oh, there was a sincere and deep effort on the part of the prosecutor, which backfired because there is a law in Texas and everywhere that any felony conviction that's over 10 years old falls under what's called the remoteness rule. It's no longer valid, and you can't talk about it. And the prosecutor insisted on doing so and was reprimanded by the judge and got so upset at the reprimand and at my attitude toward him that he lost control in the courtroom and lost a lot of points with the jury. After the case, the jury hung up. They could not come to a decision, and there was a mistrial. And I talked to the dissenting jurors afterwards, and they said that was the point at which they realized that the dedication of the prosecutor bordered on a kind of ruthlessness that may have been obliterating the truth. So I wound up far more involved and important in the case, in a way that I certainly did not want to be.
Even though he was ruled out of order, he still established your felony conviction in the minds of the jurors, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He managed to get that in before the judge and the defense attorney realized that it fell under the remoteness rule.
But I'm sure he realized it.
Oh, he knew it all along, because we were friends. And he wanted to win the case more than he wanted to keep my friendship, for which you can't blame him.
So you just can't escape this Howard Hughes image, can you?
Well, I can. I can. I try awfully hard to. It's a long time ago.
Well, there was a mistrial. Cindy went back on trial and was convicted in her second trial. But even after her conviction, she maintained a relationship with you. She would call you, isn't that true?
Not after her conviction. She used to call me during the trial, mm-hmm, to solicit my advice and just talk. And so did David West, who was by then the chief witness for the prosecution. He and I had become quite friendly during the jury selection on his trial, which lasted 10 weeks. We saw each other a lot.
Now, you must have had voluminous notes. I assume you used a tape recorder to do interviews with the various people. You had all of this. You had the court records, photographs. I see you have a lot of the police photos. Then what happened? You had all of this material, all this research material. You spent all this time in Houston. What happened after that?
Well, I had a ton of material. What happened after that is that I sat down and did what every writer has to do eventually. I wrote the book. And it's just been published, and here we are. How do you mean, what happened after
that? Well, I'm asking you how you organized all of this material and how you set about to put it together into a meaningful and coherent narrative. Or does it just come naturally?
You stumped me because I mean, every writer, I suppose, in some way has a sense of organization, or he would live in a chaotic world. And I keep good files, good records. I had several file cabinets full of transcriptions of the tapes that I did and all the notes that I took. The judge couldn't believe how I constantly scribbled. We used to go to lunch and he would say, Clifford, what are you scribbling away for all the time? He thought I was taking notes sometimes on the actual testimony. He didn't know I was tape recording. Actually, what I was doing was recording my impressions of people, visual descriptions, and my feelings about what was going on. Eventually, the prosecutor found out I was taping in the courtroom and objected vigorously, and the judge had to take the tapes away from me, but he returned them 2 days later.
Personally, the heroine in the book, Daddy's Girl, is Kim Paris, right?
That's her name.
Yeah, Kim Paris. Tell me a little bit about her. She really took a risk, didn't she, with the assumption that David West was a murderer and getting close to him.
She took a great risk, I think. She's gutsy, smart, streetwise, immoral.
Immoral?
I believe so. She didn't know David West was a murderer. He was not the chief suspect at the time. The purpose of sending Kim in to get information from David was to find out if Cindy Ray had committed the murders or hired anyone. David West was not truly suspected as the candidate. Kim promised him love, marriage, we're going to have 3 children. What would have happened had David, when he confessed, said, well, I didn't do it, Cindy did it, and she hired one of my survivalist ex-Marine Corps friends to do it? I always wondered what Kim would have done at that point. Would she have said, well, nice to have known you, buddy, so long? I think there was a deep immorality in what she did, in that kind of seduction. It paid off, but she could not know that in advance.
But that was her job, as she wasn't really a private investigator, was she, as such, but she was working in the role of one, and that was her job. It wasn't as though she were a private individual and trying to exploit that individual.
Her job, as defined by her boss, Clyde Wilson, was to befriend David West and get him to reveal anything he knew about the Campbell case. It was not to tell David that she was in love with him and that she wanted to marry him and that he was the man of her dreams. That went, I feel, beyond the call of duty.
Boy, it's almost like grasping at straws, these private detectives who set David West up like that, taking the time to develop it. It could have all just failed, and all that money involved.
Well, the family was paying, so that Kim was being recomensed.
Well, I understand that, but the family's money paying for something like this, that could have been a dead end.
Indeed, it could have, but the family suspected their sister, and they wanted to know. They wanted to set their minds at rest. They wanted to know, is she guilty or is she innocent? They didn't want to live with this feeling that their own sister may have murdered their parents. Actually, sexual entrapment is at the root of the whole story. David murdered the Campbells because, in a sense, he was entrapped by Cindy Ray, who was the only woman he had ever really been able to establish a relationship with. He's a strange guy. He's an ex-Marine, trained to kill, but never saw combat. And that rankled deep. You can imagine a Texas boy who lives in this macho world and is a trained killer, but you're not allowed to do it. And when Cindy told him that her father had seduced her at the age of 13 and her mother had stood by and let it happen, I think David saw his opportunity to fulfill his destiny, such as it was.
Now, you spent a long time in Houston. You covered the trial. You went back. You wrote the book. It's out now. Do you have you drawn any conclusions about this particular case and justice in Texas in general?
I don't think justice was done in Texas. David got life, and so did Cindy. David could be out of jail approximately 12 years from now. Cindy could be out in 7 or 8. I think David should have got the death penalty, and I don't believe Cindy should have gotten life at all. I think she should have been institutionalized under the direction of the court because she was a sick young woman. In addition, I don't believe that she was there when the murder was committed. And I think she tried to stop it at the last minute, literally at the last minute,
yeah,
when they were
some,
climbing the
confusion
stage.
About who pulled the light switch.
Yes, there was a great deal of testimony as to whether she was actually there in the room cheering David on when he shot her parents. He testified that she was, and that she had talked him into the murders. I don't believe that was true. She never testified for reasons that go deep into her psychological problems.
Well, you say David West should have been executed, but isn't it true that there might not have been a conviction in this case had he not become a witness for the prosecution?
There would not have been a conviction at all unless at some point in the future Cindy had confessed. And we have the plea bargaining system that makes it possible for people who have committed heinous crimes to get off with light sentences and, as in this case, be eligible for parole after a dozen or so years. Happens all the time. Our entire court system is based on plea bargaining and either light sentences or no sentences at all for snitches and for people who will turn state's evidence.
It makes you think because Texas is very quick to use the electric chair, isn't it?
Well, in Texas, they don't use the chair. They have death by injection, which is commonly referred to as the needle.
Yeah. Well, they're quick to use that.
Yeah. And Cindy Ray, there is a traditional defense in Texas for murder, which is never articulated, but it will work on a Texas jury and has worked in the past. And that's the basic defense that the son of a bitch needed killing. In this case, it would have been possible, had Cindy testified, to use that defense. Because from everything that I know, the dead man, James Campbell, was, I won't say a despicable man, but certainly a man with many sins and vices. And I do believe that he had sexually abused his daughter at the age of 13, and he suffered the most extreme penalty.
Well, Clifford Irving, it's a really exciting mystery case, a true one, hard to put down. You've written it just like a novel. Really hard to categorize you. Here's Daddy's Girl, and all your books are different. Tom Mix and Pancho Villa, The Death Freak, everything is different. We can't put you in a category, can we?
No, I never have, and maybe that's hurt me as a writer. I know I'm not a spy writer. I'm not just an adventure writer. The problem or the joy is that when I finish a book, I feel I've done the best I can. I've enjoyed it thoroughly, and I just don't want to repeat myself. I want to go on to a new book, which is for me a new adventure.
Well, you haven't lost your touch. It's a terrific book. Thank you very much, Clifford Irving.
Thanks, Don.